Dublab. Welcome to The Quarantine Tapes, a daily podcast from Onassis, LA and Dublab. Hosted by Paul Holdengraber, this series chronicles shifting paradigms in the era of social distancing.
Hello.
Hello, could I please speak with Danielle Spencer?
You've reached Danielle Spencer. Is this Pablo?
It is Paul calling you. I'm so happy that you could take this call, Danielle. So happy that you're part of the Quarantine Tapes, which is co-presented by Dublab and the Onassis Foundation, Onassis LA. It is such a pleasure to speak to you. Now, Danielle, if you could tell me, how have you been spending these last 11 months of this delirious period of this pandemic? And in what way, perhaps, has your life changed or not changed during that time?
I've been thinking about, my life is okay. I'm healthy. My loved ones are healthy. I'm grateful for that. I've been thinking a lot about how we have no idea how to understand what's happening to us individually and collectively. I think your project is helpful, both for us, right, all of us right now in the moment, and as a record, but we just have no idea. We have no idea. We haven't lived through this before, but I embrace that uncertainty.
And what's so interesting in your response now, Danielle, is that you've written a book now, an incredibly dense and lucid book called Metagnosis, Revelatory Narratives of Health and Identity, which in a way is about having no idea, not really knowing, not really understanding. And your laugh now at this moment makes me think that perhaps I wasn't completely foolish in characterizing it in that way. Perhaps you can tell me what you heard when I responded to you in that way and presenting your book as a book about really not knowing and then perhaps knowing better.
Well, I just love that framing, and I think it's absolutely right. And I've always been more interested in not knowing than knowing, which is a bit of a predicament in life. But when it worked out, it's a serendipitous thing. The title Metagnosis is a neologism that I coined, and the roots, roughly speaking, would mean a change in knowledge. Meta, one of the senses of the prefix being change, and then gnosis for knowledge. And the book is about the experience of learning about something about oneself, like a medical condition that one didn't know about before. So for example, if you learn in adulthood that you're colorblind, and you always assumed, because why would you not, that the colors that you see are the same as the colors that everybody else sees. And ultimately, one of the aspects of it, the key aspects of it I explore is the ways in which those revelations affect a change in the terms of knowledge, one's understanding of sense perception of identity, disability, impairment, disease. It's a lot. It unsettles a lot of those categories. And I think that is the way that you put it. That is a way of not knowing, because even if something's changed and you say, oh, okay, now I know I have this condition, I perceive colors differently than you do, whatever it is, then it could change again.
A change of knowledge, and this new knowledge in some way might in a sense also change oneself. I've always been interested in this idea, this thought, which is, do we change? And do we change, and how do we change, and how do we change our views and our opinions?
What have you come up with, Paul?
To come back to the beginning of our conversation, I really don't know. Danielle, as you know, I'm a quotomaniac by profession, and there's one line of Louise Bourgeois, the artist, that I so much love, where she says, one must accept the fact that others don't see what you do. And I'm interested in that in particular, even more so than when I knew that I wanted to read that back to you, because the example you chose was an example of being colorblind. But of course, she's not just talking about that. She's talking about the fact that in a way we don't know each other. We don't see the same thing. You don't see the same thing as I do. And I've found it so irksome when people tell me I know exactly what you feel.
Yeah, it is irksome. It is irksome because how could they? Of course, yes. There's a wonderful quote from the novelist Ben Lerner in an interview in which he said that, quote, little kids are always trying to figure out what part of their experience is shared and shareable and communicable. Really, if you're not interested in that question, you're a sociopath. You may as well be president. Of course, this was last year. so yes, empathy, but alterity, a recognition of alterity as being the ground for empathy. I mean, it's more of a Levinasian perspective.
And to come back, you invented this term, as it were, or coined this term of metagnosis from, as you said, two Greek words. The subtitle seems to me as important and perhaps more understandable immediately than the title, which is Revelatory Narratives of Health and Identity. Perhaps you can unpack those words for us in some simple way. I mean, obviously, the most important word for me there is revelatory, as if the new knowledge actually offers you the possibility of an epiphany or of a revelation.
Yes, I think, to go back to the scope of the book, the examples that I'm most focused on are these in which an individual has learned something about themselves that can be understood in a medical context. So they receive a diagnosis either because their condition was simply never diagnosed before, you know, had it been checked for, it would have been diagnosed and treated or accommodated, and or because the diagnostic boundaries have changed. And so some of the prime examples there are with mild autism spectrum disorders and ADHD. These are conditions that weren't really, they didn't properly speaking exist because the diagnostic boundaries have changed so much in recent decades. And so we talk about this a lot when it comes to kids, of course, because everybody has an opinion about, are we over-diagnosing and over-medicating children with ADHD? But alongside that, these are very important questions. Alongside that is a whole generation of adults. In many cases, their children receive these diagnoses, and then they realize, well, I was exactly the same way when I was my child's age. I would have been diagnosed with this condition. Moreover, I have this condition now. And so it's a revelation that comes without any precipitating change in their body or their circumstances, not a new condition. It's not a situation in which one's particular habitus becomes disabling because you move from one environment to another. It's a purely epistemic shift, right? You have this new knowledge, and that causes one to reconsider, particularly with these kinds of conditions, one's own identity, and it can be profoundly unsettling.
And it can be unsettling. It can be a source of grief. It can also be a source of liberation. It can be a source of consternation. It can be so many different things. And in some way, also having a word that expresses your condition might actually offer you a different perception, or seem to offer you a different perception of who you are. And thus the word, as you use it, very difficult word and a very problematic word, to say the least, of identity.
Yes.
What strikes me also, Danielle, is the movement of this extraordinary study that you've written. The arc of the book, as I see it, goes from David Byrne to Roland Barthes. And I'm wondering, I love the laugh, and I'm wondering
you just titled my life, Paul. Now I have a name for a title for my life, so thank you for that.
Well, you're very welcome. but perhaps you could help our listeners understand how we travel with you from David Byrne to Roland Barthes.
Yes, well, I worked with David as his art director for a decade, and it was a very wonderful and intense decade for me. We were very close, and it was a wonderful working relationship, lots of creativity and play and humor and lots of wonderful projects. And in the middle of that, he informally self-diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome when it started to be discussed in the mainstream press. There was a key article that came out in Wired magazine, and we were talking about it at the time. So I won't speak any further on that because that's really for him to decide, but he has spoken about it publicly, so I think it's okay. But I was struck at the time that the oddity of it being this kind of retrospective revelation that the diagnostic boundaries had changed, and so now he had this insight into his entire life. You know, these were things that he'd been dealing with and evolving. And I think it was helpful to him to have that. But it wasn't a causal explanation for his life. I mean, he's so much more than that, as is any person, right? And then so to go from Byrne to Barth, the Barth, this is nicely reflexive because Maggie Nelson's The Argonauts was a big influence for me personally and on this project. And at the beginning of The Argonauts, she quotes Barth. And let me just read this passage, this beautiful passage from the beginning of The Argonauts.
Please.
She's talking about her love for her partner, Harry. Quote, "A day or two after my love pronouncement, now feral with vulnerability, I sent you the passage from Roland Barthes by Roland Barthes, in which Barthes describes how the subject who utters the phrase, I love you, is like, quote, the Argonaut renewing his ship during its voyage without changing its name. Just as the Argo's parts may be replaced over time, but the boat is still called the Argo, whenever the lover utters the phrase, I love you, its meaning must be renewed by each use, as, quote, the very task of love and language is to give to one and the same phrase inflections which will be forever new." And ultimately, using this particular phenomenon, which I call metanosis, this kind of retrospective revelation, I use it as a kind of wedge to destabilize or constructively deconstruct our understanding of identity with a view toward empowering us to be able to reconstruct it. But with the premise being that it's always in flux, it's always changing. For if you can have a revelation that you are not who you thought yourself to be, this is a cribbing a quote of Simon Critchley talking about Oedipus, then that means that it could always happen. And that's going back to the uncertainty and the unknowing that is the ground of our existence. So that's the arc. That's one way of describing the arc, I think.
It's interesting also to me that you mentioned Simon Critchley, who I had occasion to speak to early on in this chronicle of our times, the Quarantine Tapes. And he said that this moment, and he spoke with me maybe in April or May of last year. We've been at it for quite some time, as we all know. And he said that this moment of the pandemic is a very philosophical moment. I'm wondering how that resonates with you.
Well, I completely agree. I would love to speak with him about it, but I'm very happy to be speaking with you about it right now. But I also do see it in a continuum with this project of mine, because you know, I was trying to describe how these instances, as bewildering as they can be, of these kind of medical revelations, can be also, you know, productively deconstructive in a way. I do think writ large, that's also what we're going through. I mean, we've always known that we could have a large scale pandemic, but it's not happened in any of our lifetimes. So now it's happening. We've always known of our own mortality. Many of us are having to face that or face the actual mortality of our loved ones in ways that we haven't had to before. We've always, I should be careful about saying we, our society has been plagued with the disease of systemic racism and oppression since the beginning. Some of us are becoming newly aware of the extent of that now, but the disease has been there all along. What do you do when the revelation comes? And yet it's a revelation that is also retrospective. In the face of that, I think these are profoundly important questions to be asking and gives us the opportunity to emerge with perhaps a different, more helpful understanding of ourselves.
One hopes. And in many ways, also your book gives a new twist to, you know, the most fundamental philosophical question one could possibly imagine of gnotiseoton, you know thyself. And one might ask the question to Daniel Spencer, you know, how important is it, in fact, to know oneself? And is that endeavor even possible?
Well, I mean, as Socrates explains in Plato's Apology, surely it is the most blameworthy ignorance to believe that one knows what one does not know. If I were to claim that I'm wiser than anyone in anything, it would be in this. So alongside that knowledge is a good dose of humility, I would say. But I'm just cribbing from Plato. So,
you know, Andrew Solomon has a question for you, and he'd like you to unpack this notion that is central, really, to your book. The relationship between diagnosis, another word formed from Greek, and prognosis. How does a diagnosis alter truly, deeply, a patient or a person's discomfort with her or his or their condition?
How does a diagnosis alter a person's discomfort?
Discomfort.
Discomfort. What an interesting question. Thank you, Andrew. I don't think you can answer these questions in the general case because it's so rare. But that in itself is really helpful to understand because each time an individual receives, even that is puts the patient in the passive role, a diagnosis, the effects are different, right? And so in some cases, it can be liberating and helpful. In other cases, it can be profoundly constraining. Sometimes, many times, there are aspects of it that are one or the other simultaneously. What it does is it brings the individual into relationship with what Charles Rosenberg, who's a historian of science and medicine, calls the institutionalized, bureaucratized space of diagnosis, meaning in the abstract, there are these disease entities that exist, their diagnostic categories, their vast electronic medical records and institutionalized knowledge and so forth. The individual gets mapped into that Baudrillardian, simulacrum and has very little agency over what happens to that version of oneself. And so the diagnosis or the prognosis are both ways in which the individual is absorbed into this matrix, if you will. What metanosis, the way that I conceive of it, is it's trying to restore more agency to the individual because how one situates this kind of revelation is really more up in the air.
Right.
You could find out, Paul, that you have a condition that you didn't know about right now, and you could find out that you're quote unquote colorblind or have something, ADHD, whatever. And I would not know how you would respond. You might say, oh my God, I have to revisit everything in my entire life. Or you could say, so what?
Right. And does it give me a different perception of myself? And I know in the book you mention in passing, but importantly, the work of Dani Shapiro. And I'm wondering how she fits into this whole notion of revisiting, or perhaps not really only revisiting, but desperately trying to find out about our own origins.
Yes, Dani Shapiro is a wonderful example. I write about her in the last chapter, particularly her beautiful 2019 memoir, which is called Inheritance, a Memoir of Genealogy, Paternity, and Love. And she experienced a genomic paternity revelation, which is to say that her father, she learned only in the middle of her life, was not her biological parent. And I see this as an example of metanosis because it's a revelation of knowledge about oneself that changes the terms of knowledge. Didn't change anything materially about her, but it had a profound effect on her that was very destabilizing for a time. And then, and this goes to the meta and the metanosis part, the change in knowledge, she worked through it. She went on a journey, as she calls it, and she emerged with a changed understanding of what it means to be a father, what it means to be a daughter, in a really profoundly beautiful way.
So this new knowledge can really change the way we think about ourselves. And I'm also thinking about, the so much self-diagnosis is going on, but there's also at times, and I'm thinking particularly of certain artists like Rainer Maria Rilke refusing through Lou Andrea Salomé to ever visit Freud to get a diagnosis of his own condition, not wanting to know, not wanting that revelation, as it were, wanting to hold on, if not to the disease, to what prompts, at least in artistic ways, a certain form of creativity. And I'm thinking of this wonderful line of Tennessee Williams, which I'd love you to react to in the context, really, of metagnosis, where he says, if I got rid of my demons, I'd lose my angels.
Yes. Well, Robert Lowell said he stopped writing poetry when he started taking lithium. I mean, this is looking at artists and how they, their relationship to whether you call it demons, which is often sort of a metaphor for psychiatric illness, right? Or other types of labels. I mean, artists and writers are trying to break out of structures, right? Reform the structures. And so have a particularly interesting, in my view, relationship to these, because a label can be constraining. It can also be liberating, but it's totalizing in a way. Freud says that you have whatever kind of neurosis you have, then what are you going to do?
Right. I often think of the Lawrence Stern line that to define is to distrust. I'm curious, Danielle, now, what prompted you to write this book? And in some way, it's a very academic book, But in another way, I see it as a just slightly disguised memoir.
Yes. Just slightly disguised. It's just wearing a top hat, right?
Yeah, just slightly disguised. This, perhaps you can take us, Danny Shapira takes us on a journey. Perhaps you can also briefly take us on your own journey of discovery and perhaps self-discovery and what that discovery really afforded you. Did it change who Danielle Spencer is or thinks about when she thinks about herself and her former self?
Are you referring to the personal, the autobiographical portions of it?
Your autobiographical perception and then really what led you, I mean, these are a lot of questions to pile up on each other, but what really led you to this investigation, which is, you know, you're writing in a way an academic book, which is disguised as a memoir, which has an autobiographical element to it.
I think each way of describing it is disguised as something else. It's like, yeah, well, something happened to me, which was the genesis of the book. The precursor was being there when David had this experience, but that wasn't a big thing in my life. It was just something that happened mostly to him. And but then some years later, I had a revelation of what's called a visual field defect. Of course, when you're talking about these things, anything in the health humanities or disability studies, you have to put scare quotes over all these terms because they're all problematic, right? But that's what it's called, which is, so I learned well into adulthood that I see half of what I imagine you see, Paul, although I don't know.
Right.
I shouldn't presume to know what you see. And it turned out to be the effects of an old stroke that probably happened around the time I was born, although it wasn't detected at the time. And so there was a lot of medical, there was a whole workup, there was lots of kind of clutter around that. But once the clutter cleared, I was left with this awareness and my vision was the same as it has always been. And yet I was not seeing to one side. There's a further revelation after that, which was that after some period of time, I realized that I have on my quote unquote blind side, I have what's called blind sight, which is, wait for it, unconscious vision. We all have it. Most of us are not consciously aware of it, or not all of us. I shouldn't say that, because some people don't have any vision. So when that happened, I was so bewildered by it. I couldn't really account for it to people in my life because nothing had materially changed. But I was fascinated by that difficulty. It didn't map onto any of my experience of how people talked about things that happened to them in the domain of health and medicine and so forth. I was really interested in it. And I think that was my way of coping with it, was to get curious about it. And that was really the genesis of this whole book. It was an open question. My father's a mathematician, and he, you know, I was raised in the school of, you know, the beauty of the integers and so forth. And the way questions are always where one begins. Interesting problems, interesting open questions. And so I started off with that. I thought I was interested by the fact that I didn't understand it. And I didn't really see much out there where people were looking at this phenomenon qua itself. You know, it's usually in some other, you know, the context of whatever condition was being revealed. And so I set out to investigate it.
And that led also to a professional change.
Yes.
which is interesting, of joining a field that I imagine also needs some footnoting, which is the field of narrative medicine.
Yes, indeed. Narrative medicine, I'm the academic director of the Columbia Narrative Medicine Program, and it is a young field. And I was drawn to it, I think, because of my interest in this, in what had happened. I was drawn to it also because I didn't really know what it was. And I'm always drawn to things going back to the theme of unknowing.
Yeah.
I'm always interested in things that I don't understand.
I still don't know what narrative medicine is.
Yes. Well, let me just give the short definition for your sake and for our listeners' sake, which narrative medicine is a field that began as a way of practicing medicine. So for practicing clinicians to treat their patients with an attentiveness to narrative. So you, Paul, if you come to the doctor, then you're not simply a collection of discrete organ systems or body parts. You actually are a person. You have lived experience. And narrative is, I think, just a useful framework for centering the treatment on your lived experience. But then also how you understand it yourself would be how you might tell it and form the story, right? So that's the way the field began. But since then, it's expanded quite a bit. So it's really a very interdisciplinary field that's looking at narratives are still at the center of it, but narratives of healthcare and illness narratives, disability, the pandemic. One of the focuses is always trying to elevate the voices of people who are traditionally disempowered in these spaces. And so that's what the field is. And I do see this book as being squarely within the field while also reaching out to many other discourses.
Is this also a way of helping doctors become better readers?
Yes, that's the foundational definition of the field. Yes, but I offer I very much appreciate that and agree with it. And then I offer an evolution of that model, which is to say that if that's the exclusive model, then it still privileges the clinician as being the reader or skilled reader or translator or listener to the patient text, if you will. And what I advocate for is that we all of us, whatever role you're occupying, and we often are shifting roles, we all must be better readers and engaged and empowered when it comes to, well, healthcare, medicine, disability, but frankly, everything. And that's actually, you mentioned Barthes before, and that's Barthes' conception of the writerly text. So the writerly text is one in which the reader is engaged. You know, it's the jouissance instead of plaisir, or not instead of, but in addition to. It's not about closure. It's an open text, and it's one that invites the active bewilderment and participation of the reader.
And in that way, doctors need to become better semiologists, and and patients need to have the time to tell their stories to a receptive and creative ear. And in that way, I'm thinking also about whether this program at Columbia in some way is trying to rekindle the possible friendship between medicine and storytelling.
Yes, very much so. Very much so. Which has been there all along, but it goes quiet for long stretches. And look, there's a widespread recognition that we need to do something. We need to rehumanize this healthcare quote unquote system for everybody's sake. You know, the clinicians are miserable, the patients are miserable, and this is a whole whole other podcast to talk about it. But there are a lot of different attempts to address this. This is one of them. And I see them all as being allied. I don't see them as being mutually exclusive. I mean, I'm in this field. I believe in it. But whatever helps, we need it all.
There would be so many more questions to ask you about this, and to ask you about how important maybe Oliver Sacks has been in that very field, and how important in this time of the pandemic, precisely the fact that we can't really touch each other has a huge influence on diagnosis, on how we live our lives, and perhaps even on diseases that have come from lack thereof. Earlier in our conversation, Danielle, you spoke about the fact that many of the problems that have haunted us for so long have become clearer or more visible or more palpable, as it were, because of this pandemic. So in closing, I'd like you to comment on this idea that was brought about many, many months ago by Arundhati Roy when she wrote a splendid piece in The Guardian, where she said that the pandemic was in fact a portal. And I'm wondering how you see that to be the case.
I thought that was a beautiful piece, and I agreed completely. Yes, I mean, I love that way of understanding it, the portal, because one doesn't know what's on the other side, but it's an invitation to explore it and to explore it with fortitude and grace. What else can we do, Paul? I mean, I do see, going back to the beginning, I see a through line from an individual experience that one might have of a specific person, a specific diagnosis in a specific context. And then the question becomes, okay, what's the understanding of this that's going to be most helpful to that person? How might it reframe our understanding, right? And in some cases, it's a change in knowledge that can be helpful and empowering. And from that to a broader societal and historical level, when society itself, when we are suffering such loss and such dramatic change and trauma, how can we see through to understand our predicament better and to see what portals we might climb through and what we might hope for on the other side.
Danielle, it's been a real pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much for taking the time, and I'm looking forward to the time when we will be able to see each other. In the meantime, I invite our listeners to read your book and to think about these very issues, which are so complex and so interesting to contemplate and so important for us actually to think about in this time of the pandemic, but also when such a time comes to an end. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Paul. It's been such a joy to speak with you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
To support this show and DubLab's progressive programming, go to dublab.com/support.